So, the Buddha's last words, the last two words that he spoke, according to the discourse, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the story of the last year of the Buddha's life. And these two words are with mindfulness strive on, appamadena sampadita. And yeah, as I say, I think there's an awful lot of the Buddha's teaching kind of encapsulated, summarized, referenced, pointed to in these last two words. And it's an opportunity for me to give a talk on two really key and very connected themes, which are, on the one hand, mindfulness, and on the other hand, effort, the nature of the sort of effort that's involved in practicing the Dharma, in practicing the Buddha's teachings. And it's relevant from the word go, really, because the first thing we do on a drop-in class may well be to teach the mindfulness of breathing. And in order to practice mindfulness breathing method meditation, you need to make some degree of effort, and quite what sort of effort is well, very much part of the art of meditation. So that's something I'll be going into in a minute. But firstly, mindfulness. Now, mindfulness is a bit of a sort of collective term that we're using to refer to a number, a range of terms that the Buddha used. So he didn't have just one word that we're translating as mindfulness. There are three which form a bit of a group. Most of the time when the Buddha's talking about what we call mindfulness, he's talking about one of these three things. Appamadena is definitely one of them. The other two are sati and sampajanya. And I want to go into a bit about what sort of three facets of this state of mind that we call mindfulness, drawn out by these three terms. And this is, I'm not trying to be original, this is a teaching that I've come to an understanding of through my own involvement in the movement. But I thought I'd better put a caveat in that I did look up all these words before doing the talk this evening in the dictionary, Pali dictionary, and actually they all come out with a translation that's just a cluster of words that mean something like mindfulness. So I'm going to be making distinctions between these three terms that are drawing out three aspects of mindfulness, and that's a teaching that's quite current within our movement, but you won't find it in the dictionary. So I wanted to start by saying a bit about what each of these things means to me, at least. And quite often the third one, appamada, is often left out, and people talk about mindfulness in terms of satipatthana. And the two qualities that are involved here are, on the one hand, awareness of the present moment of your experience. So this is usually associated with sati. This is really being here now. It's very big in the Zen tradition. You may well have heard phrases such as be here now. And it's very much an aspect of mindfulness. And perhaps the thing to point out here is that it's not the whole story. It's a key aspect of mindfulness, so it's not the whole story. Because there's also sampajanya, and that sort of is, in a way, is a balancing quality. And from sampajanya, we're looking at continuity of purpose. So a sense of ongoing purpose in what we're doing. So again, in the meditations that we do, whatever meditation we're doing, really, it doesn't have to be the mindfulness of breathing, there's going to be a focus of concentration in the meditation. And a lot of the skill required is the ability to stay present, to stay with your current experience. Whatever that is. And balancing that, you need this accompanying quality of having an ongoing sense of purpose. So if you don't have an ongoing sense of purpose, you're going to drift off. You're going to start being here now, and you're going to get distracted, and you're not going to come back because you haven't got an ongoing sense of purpose. It's going to do that for you. Without sati, sampajanya on its own, can get rather narrow, rather kind of focusing on the future rather than what's happening now. One easy failing in meditation, in our approach to meditation, is to try and be in a different state of mind to the one we're in, and that doesn't work because it's just not honest. We're not in a different state of mind to the one we're in. And yes, meditation has to be about really acknowledging your current experience and working from where you're at. It's impossible to work from anywhere other than where you're actually at in meditation. Conversely, it's very, very possible to work effectively with where you're at, whatever that state is, however painful or destructive that state is. If you can really come into your current experience, you can work very effectively and creatively with that. So that's sati sampajanya, and they seem like a complete sort of picture in themselves, really. You think, oh great, sati sampajanya, that covers it surely. So what's this third one, appamardena, which must have been really important, because that was the one the Buddha chose in his last words. Well, the point about sati and sampajanya, and also about concentration, if you like, so concentration is a translation of samadhi, that's another term. And so you can see mindfulness as a practice, as an activity that's moving you towards a different state of mind, and you can see concentration as, if you like, the goal of mindfulness practice. It's the state of absorption, of integration, of gatheredness, of concentration. And meditation is a word that we use to translate, well, sometimes one, sometimes the other. But so hopefully you get the idea that there is a difference between the activity that we're undertaking and the state of mind that we're trying to move towards. So meditation as an activity is about really acknowledging and being in your current experience. Concentration, or meditation as concentration, as a concentrated state of mind, is the sort of quality of mind that we're trying to move towards. So those are, if you like, the two wings of enlightenment. You need to know where you are, and you need to know where you're going. If you've got both of those, then you can really fly. But coming back to the point about mindfulness, sati and sampajanya, and also concentration, are not necessarily ethical. They're not necessarily ethical. If you look in, there's a sort of whole section of the Dharma that unpicks the states of mind that you can occupy, the sort of mental events that happen. And they divide them up into intrinsically skillful, intrinsically unskillful, and neutral. And sati is a neutral, is a neutral state of mind. And what they mean by that is that whether it's ethical or not depends on the object. I think it's actually quite important to recognize that concentration, mindfulness, awareness is not intrinsically ethical. It depends what you're focused on. And I think this does get lost sometimes, particularly in the Zen tradition. So to take a few examples, you know, if we're actually focused on trying to move towards a more skillful state of mind, trying to move towards enlightenment, trying to develop our understanding of the reality of things as they are, trying to empathize more with people, recognize that we're not separate. That's very, very skillful. And there was one guy that I remember who came to meditation classes in Manchester. He wanted to improve his golf swing. That's neutral. maybe it depends why you want to improve your golf swing, but generally that's neutral. Mindfulness and concentration techniques are widely used in the martial arts, and they're used, and sometimes that's just a sport, but sometimes that's used to be practiced, to be more effective in martial practice. And, well, that's unethical. Yeah, non-violence is the key to the ethical system of the Buddha. Non-violence is the root precept, if you like. And moreover, concentration is not in itself skillful or unskillful, but it does really make your intentions much more weighty. Okay. So in Buddhism, in Buddhist ethics, intention is everything, really. So if you do something completely unintentional, it might have rather unfortunate consequences, but that's not in itself unskillful. at the other end of the spectrum, if you do something with full concentration and awareness of what you're doing, that is very weighty karma. So the good news is that if you can really focus your practice, if you can really get into a state of concentration in your meditation and really practice the Dharma with awareness, with mindfulness, with concentration, that's very weighty positive karma. Now this is perhaps in a roundabout way bringing me to Appamada, this third aspect of mindfulness. Because Appamada, sometimes called heedfulness, is intrinsically ethical, and it's intrinsically ethical because what it is an ethical sensitivity. It's a sensitivity to the ethical tone of our experience. Does it have the tone or the feeling quality of something skillful, or the feeling quality of tone of something unskillful? And so it's very akin to conscience. And it's this sort of mindfulness, it's this sort of awareness that the Buddha is saying you need to bring to your practice, to your effort, in his closing words. And in a way it kind of encompasses the whole of mindfulness, because along with this sensitivity, you're not going to be sensitive to something you're not aware of, obviously. It implies this being in the moment, this awareness of your current experience in the moment. And it implies an ongoing purpose to move towards the skillful. I think if you're really aware of the good, you're going to want to move towards the good. People are very rarely unskillful with malice aforethought, so to speak, deliberately. It's usually through unawareness and ignorance. In particular, it's through a lack of appamada, a lack of ethical sensitivity. So when we do have this sensitivity to the karmic quality of our experience, to the ethical wholesomeness of our skillful experience, and to the ethical unwholesomeness of our unskillful experience, we'll naturally want to move towards the good. So following on from that, just to say, well, mindfulness itself intrinsically isn't skillful or unskillful. Also, mindfulness meditation is not uniquely Buddhist. The Buddha himself probably learned a practice akin to the mindfulness of breathing from one of his meditation teachers before he gained enlightenment. It's been around longer than Buddhism. It's certainly more widely applied than in Buddhism. And there's quite a bit of mindfulness practice around nowadays. It seems to be very much in vogue. Mindfulness-based something or other. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, depression, mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness-based practices for living well with pain and illness and so on. All of these are good things. And they're not Buddhist. So we don't have a monopoly on on good things. However, mindfulness of breathing, as taught by the Buddha, as part of the Dharma, is intrinsically Buddhist, and it's intrinsically Buddhist in two particular ways, I think, on reflection myself. So this is sort of perhaps not traditional, but it's just, I suppose, it's my view in the area. So firstly, it's intrinsic to the mindfulness that's part of the Buddhist practice of meditation, is this quality, appamada, of ethical sensitivity. And it's not just a feeling, a type of feeling, it's a type of understanding as well, because it needs to be rooted into an understanding of ethics. That ethics is the playing out of conditionality in the area of karma. So karma is the way in which our actions are connected to the consequences of our actions. So we act, our actions have consequences for ourselves and for others. And this is part of the way that the world works. The way the world works is described as through experiences arising in dependence upon conditions, and events arising in dependence on conditions, and the conditions change, then the experience changes or passes away. That's a very broad teaching. It applies on a number of levels. One very, very important level, arguably for us where we are now, the most important level on which that applies is that it applies in the level of karma. And karma is describing the way in which our actions, particularly our volitional actions, are kind of linked to the consequences of our action. If we act with a skillful mind, then positive, enjoyable, happy. It's difficult to kind of encapsulate in an adjective the quality of the result of a skillful action. It's something very positive, very expansive, very human, very worthwhile. Conversely, if we act, even think actually, but particularly if we speak or act with coming from an unskillful volition, then suffering follows. Suffering follows very directly. Now, initially, that's just going to be a teaching that we've heard, that we may sort of provisionally agree with, that we may not have particularly thought about. Even if it's a teaching that we agree with, it's maybe just an idea in our minds. But the more we can get in touch with Appamada in particular, the more it's going to be not just an idea that we have or assent to, it's going to be part of our direct experience. The Dharma, the Buddha's Dharma is described as immediately apparent, Sanghitika. And what that means to me is that when I look at my experience right now, here in the moment, I can see the Dharma happening. And what I see in my immediate experiences are, well, experiences arise, conditions change, experiences changing. I also, if I'm sensitive enough, I can see, well, this is the tone of my intention. This is the nature of my experience. And I can start to see the way in which those two are connected, actually happening. You know, actually, when I do this, this follows. I can actually see that connection happening in my experience. To do that, to be able to see that, we need to be aware of what our experience is, and we need to be aware of what the ethical tone of our experience is. So that's this Appamada. And it's subtle to a degree. It takes a certain amount of practice to get in touch with it, perhaps. It depends where we're starting from. When we sit down to meditate, it's straightforward to get in touch with the breath, because the breath is a physical experience. Just as the contact of my body with the seat and with the mat is a physical experience, I can connect with that directly. A lot of people find the metta bhavana more difficult because you're trying to get in touch with an emotion, and emotions can be kind of tenuous, they can be kind of subtle and indirect and not immediately apparent, perhaps. The ethical tone of our experience, similarly, may not be so immediately apparent, because it's something akin, it's a quality of mind, it's a quality, and emotions are like qualities as well. So it's not just something hard and physical and objective and unarguably present, it's a sort of quality to our experience. So perhaps it takes a little bit of practice, a little bit of sensitivity, a little bit of patience to kind of get in touch with that. And it's definitely there, because we're all human, and it's very much part of what it is to be human. We have this human awareness, it's a really remarkable thing. And the distinctive, unique, remarkable quality of being human, rather than being an animal with pure just sense awareness, is that we have this awareness of ourselves as an independent ethical agent, as somebody who can actually act, make choices, as someone who experiences different consequences according to the choices we make. And this whole area of how karma plays out, and this whole area of the ethical tone of our experience, that's human awareness, that's human consciousness. So we can all do it because we're all human, through very, very directly. And it's because we're human that we can gain enlightenment. The Buddha was a man, he was born, he was a human being, just as we are human beings, and he had the same human experience that we're having right now. So that's Appamada. So the other thing I wanted to talk about is strive on, Sampadeta. What I'd like to call balanced effort. So Bhavanasatra is a phrase that came from the meditation team at Vajralokā some time back, and they've rather distanced themselves from it now, and they sort of say, no, sort of talk about appropriate effort rather than balanced effort, because balanced effort might mean you're not making as much effort as you might do, I suppose. But I really like balanced effort, so I'm going to stick with it. And I think it's balanced in a number of different, quite distinct, quite key ways. And so I'm going to talk about three of those. So the first is a balance between, on the one hand, being idle, and on the other hand, being willful. And I think this is a quality of balance that Bhavata was trying to draw out just before the meditation earlier on this evening, that in a sense, the degree of effort we want to make to stay focused is as little as possible. It might sound strange, but that's sort of my suggestion. If you're not quite sure where exactly that point is, you're probably better off erring on the side of making less. So perhaps I ought to explain myself. That sounds really untoward. And perhaps it sounds something in rather a contrast to this admonition of the Buddha just before he died. He said, with mindfulness, strive on, strive, make an effort. Well, we certainly need to make an effort to practice the Dharma and to change. And the extreme of idleness is just going to be ineffective. We're not going to change unless we actually apply ourselves. However, the extreme of willfulness is liable to build up resistance, and is liable to narrow down our awareness. And this can be a rather pernicious trap, because the first thing that it narrows out of our awareness is the fact that we're being willful, and the fact that our awareness is rather narrow. And so what can happen, I think this happened to me, I'm not entirely sure whether it's true or not, but looking back on my own experience of meditation over the years, I certainly got to a point where I experienced just so much resistance that I pretty much couldn't carry on. I certainly couldn't carry on the way I was, and I meditated a lot less for a while. And I think what I've been doing is just on a habitual and regular basis being a bit too willful. Not necessarily a lot too willful, just habitually a little bit too willful. And that this resistance was kind of building up and building up and building up over time, until it just kind of reached a tipping point and just couldn't do it anymore. And you hear a lot of people describing that sort of experience in the movement. I don't think it's uncommon at all. So that's my main reason for suggesting, if you're not quite sure where the balance is, err on the side of less. And so, coming back to the quality of balanced effort in meditation, I think the first two stages are quite a good way of describing this, because in a way the sort of tone of voice that we use with the counting can say an awful lot about the quality of effort that we're using. And sometimes that tone can be quite harsh, and there's one older member was sort of leading a meditation, and he said, and if you find that you're distracted, just bring the mind back to the breathing. And then he thought for a moment, and then he said, I don't mean bring your mind back to breathing the way a police snatch squad would bring a burglar back to justice. So that might ring some bells for us, and how when we're unthinking, we can sort of be rather willful in that way. Insensitive as well. So what's the more skillful approach is to have a much gentler, sort of bringing back. So someone wants to use this sort of visual image of the a mind as like a little puppy, and a little puppy has this tendency to sort of suddenly gain interest in something and rush up over there, and you sort of kind of pick it up and bring it back, and so on. You try and do that gently. So that's the quality of balanced effort in that sense of gentleness. And a parallel I've used on meditation courses as well is, if you imagine opening a door, if you use too much effort, you're probably going to, perhaps hurt your hand, perhaps slam the door open. It can feel very rough and clumsy, and you're actually using a lot more force than you need to open the door. If you use too little effort, the door won't open. You just won't push hard enough to open the door. So a balanced effort in the sense of just enough to actually get the effect you want. Well, think in terms of, turning that door handle, pushing the door open. Just the effort you need. And to actually get that just on, you need to know the door. Different doors need different quantities of effort. Different states of mind need different quantities of effort. So that's balance between willfulness and idleness. The second quality of balance I wanted to draw out is balance between breadth and focus. So is breadth and focus, is that a teaching that you're familiar with from, hopefully from meditation courses, from meditation practice? It's all presumably from your familiar ground, hopefully. Focus, yes, our meditation practice, it does have a focus, and there is an effort to stay with the focus. That is part of the effort. There's also an endeavour in meditation practice to broaden our awareness. And actually we're trying to do both at the same time, really, ideally. We're trying to broaden out and stay focused at the same time. An image that works for me is like a very shallow bowl. And if my mind is still, if you imagine my awareness is like this little marble or ball at the bottom of the bowl, my mind is still, that marble will just stay where it's at the bottom of the bowl. And the stiller my mind is, the shallower the bowl can be, and the marble will just stay there. And eventually you might have just completely level, a completely level experience, and the marble would stay there because it's just not inclined to go anywhere else. That's one sort of image we have for a type of samadhi called the direction of samadhi. But in my mind, it's an image of perfect balance of breadth and focus. The more stillness I have, the less effort to focus I'm going to need, until eventually there's no effort at all. And we may find that our states are in this sort of mind in the period just sitting, just after meditation. We stop making any sort of an effort, but sort of as a consequence of the effort we've already made, our minds are still, they're not actually inclined to move elsewhere, and the mind can just stay stationary, present, aware, just as it is, in quite a level, expanse of broad awareness. Yes, now I think there's a connection. I think, a willful approach will tend to over-focus. We'll tend to get rather narrow, we'll tend to be excluding aspects of our experience. An idle approach, well, we'll probably be going all over the place. so we might cover a certain breadth at a time. But really, a broad awareness kind of does need awareness. It does need quality of mindfulness. And so, to develop broad awareness, we're trying to acknowledge where we're at as fully as possible. We're trying to not hold anything at bay, not keep anything out, not deny any aspect of our experience. There's a quote that Satchari is very fond of, quoting from an older man called Achilo, and he said, what's kept out controls. If there's some aspect of our experience that we're just trying to pretend isn't there. It's like trying to hold a sort of inflatable ball under the water. It's just controlling your whole experience. You're putting all your effort into trying to not be aware of that. Yes, we have to let everything in. We have to make an effort from where we're at, and that involves being fully acknowledging, being fully prepared to let in what our current experience is, even if it's not what we'd like it to be, not who we think we are, if it's not concentrated, if it's not mindful, if it's not metaphor. We can only meditate effectively on the basis of a sort of honest accepting of where we're at. Okay. So accepting is a word that I'm quite ambivalent about, but one thing I think we definitely need to accept is we need to accept that we are where we are. Our current experience is what it is. Yes, what we don't want to accept is that it's going to carry on being like that. Because we're trying to change. Okay, so one final aspect of balance I wanted to draw out. And this one's a more difficult one to get across, I think. It's perhaps a more subtle one. And perhaps what I'm going to say is not going to make a lot of sense, but you know, you can always ask me afterwards to try and clarify if that's going to help. So I've described this as a balance between a self-centric approach and an other-centric approach. I didn't want to say self-centered because that sounds a bit kind of selfish or something. One way it's often described is self-power or other power. And so what I mean by a self-centric approach is an approach to practice in general, and mindfulness practice in particular, mindfulness of breathing, meditation perhaps in particular, that's about, here am I making an effort to change my own state of mind through my own endeavor, through my own effort. It's sort of personal growth and development. It's a sort of quite psychological take on practice, if you like. It's I'm an autonomous individual, I'm making a choice to do this practice, through my own efforts I can change myself. And that's true, through my own efforts I can change myself. It's a valid approach to practice, and it's perhaps, I think it's fair to say it's probably the most widespread approach in the West. It's sort of where our background is, I think, now. But we live in a very secular society. We live in a society that's got a very psychological sort of model of human experience. And so that's the sort of view that we're liable to come to the Dharma from. And so we're liable to engage with Dharma practice as personal growth and development, as self-power, self-development, if you like. Now we may find that over time this becomes less we may find there's a certain limit to how far we can get with that, and some people kind of get to this rather distressing point of thinking there's no way I can gain enlightenment through my own efforts, and if you feel that and you also feel that's your only option, then that's quite a difficult place to be. So on the other side of the balance, other-centric or other power, the first thing I wanted to draw out is something that's actually quite direct in all of our experience, which is that it's a lot easier to practice collectively, generally, than it is to practice on our own. The Sangha is very supportive when it comes to meditation, practicing in the context of a shrine room with a number of other people. I certainly find it a lot easier to do that than I do to practice meditation on my own, in my own space, with no sangha there. So, it is difficult to establish a regular daily practice, which is going to be, in the majority of days, on your own, in your own space, through your own efforts, or perhaps amongst people that don't share your practice. You know, so perhaps if you're living in a family and you're the only one there that's actually trying to meditate, that's trying to do this, that's difficult. And it's very supportive to try and engage with collective practice in the Sangha as much as you can. That's a very supportive approach, and many people in the movement have taken that to into a sort of full-time living context. So living in community, one of the main motivations for doing that is so that actually you can have this supportive collective Sangha context all the time. Certainly in all of your morning meditations and evenings and living contexts. So that's an aspect of a sort of another centric approach, another power approach. It's not that somebody else is doing your meditation for you, it's just that actually meditating collectively, we support each other. So we're supported by the community, by the Sangha that we're practicing in. We also support the people around us. Sometimes it's actually quite a motivating approach to practice to think in terms of, I'm doing this for everybody else as well. I mean, even if you're not actually particularly concentrated, you can think in terms of, the more I can keep still and quiet, the more supportive the conditions are going to be for everybody else in this room. If you're at the level of practice that's actually, I'm feeling really restless and I want to, you know, ruffle and shuffle and make lots of noise. One thing that's quite motivating is just to actually just to keep others in mind and think, actually, I really appreciate a supportive environment, which is about being together, but being together with quietness and stillness and sense of collective concentration. And we very much do contribute to that. Sometimes it's easy to overlook and to think, oh, it's all coming in from the environment, but we're part of the environment. If there's 20 people sitting in the shrine room meditating together, the one person that's me is quite a substantial part of that 20 people. So that's perhaps the most immediate aspect of an other-centric or other-power approach. Over time, we may find that, yes, our practice is supported by the immediate community that we're practicing within. We may get more and more of an imaginative connection with the more sort of ideal or archetypal Sangha, with the Sangha of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the figures that we see depicted on the shrines, with the Sangha as refuge. So, as practicing Buddhists, our three refuges are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And the Sangha as a refuge is the community of enlightened or enlightened beings and beings with a very decisive spiritual insight who are irrevocably directed towards enlightenment. And perhaps the most clear connection with that is through this sort of more symbolic or archetypal realm of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that kind of express that refuge for us. And but as part of the opening up of an awareness, actually we do sort of open up more of a sense of the imaginative, more of an imaginal faculty, more of a responsiveness. And ritual practices is much more directly orientated towards these figures. And the more we can actually bring that aspect of mindfulness, which is about breath and receptivity and openness to experience, into the pujas and the other rituals that you do, the more responsive we'll find that we are, and the more engaged we find we are, and they do really support each other. So you probably have found that in order to practice Metta-Bhava, you need a pretty good support of mindfulness. You need the ability to sit focused on a space within which your emotional experience is going to play itself out and arise. And initially you may find, well, actually, I don't really feel very much at all, you know. Well, in that context, what we need to do in the Metta-Bhavana is to sort of remain patiently broad, be aware of that space around the heart center where the emotion experience arises and changes and passes, and just wait patiently with that sort of breath, awareness, receptivity, mindfulness. So mindfulness is the sort of fuel, if you like, for Metta-Bhavana practices. And just in the same way, mindfulness is the supportive base for ritual practice, for puja as well. And this is a sort of opening up to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And we can certainly get to the point where we're drawing strength, inspiration, support from these archetypal figures in our imagination. Sometimes people talk in terms of a very direct experience of them. Now in the end, one final enigma to leave you with, in the end, from a Buddhist perspective, there's no essential self. There's no essential self, me, at the centre of my experience. And there's no essential world or others outside of the centre of my experience. So in terms of talking about, well, I'm more self-centric, I'm more other-centric, I'm more self-power, I'm more other power, in the end, what the Buddha's teaching is that there isn't a fixed essential self at the middle, there isn't a fixed essential world outside, there are no fixed essential other people out there. What's actually real is experience, and experience is happening in that liminal space, in that boundary, in that transition space between self and other. If we just bring our awareness directly into our experience, then you'll see this, and sort of just become aware of what our experience of that actually is, what's the most apparent thing in my experience now, what actually is that? Is that me? Is that somebody else? Is that the world? In the end, the answer to all of those questions has to be no. It's my experience. My experience is happening somewhere between the two. And ultimately, there's no self and there's no other further experience to happen in between. These are just ideas we have. I have this experience. Somehow, within that experience, this idea that there's this substantial me in here has arisen. And somehow, along with that, has arisen this idea that, well, there's 14 other people out there, along with a big world, the world outside. All those are ideas about the world, about myself. What's actually direct in my experience is neither one nor the other. And it's at this point of experience that we can transform through our own efforts. This is where we have to transform our experience where it is. Our experience is neither inside nor outside, it's somewhere between the two. So that's the point of balance at which we can actually change our experience and become different. So, that sums it up. So in summary, I'd just like to say, with mindfulness, drive on.